the Burnside Bridge. So cross a bridge or don't cross a bridge. Just come over to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and you can look at this for yourself, this book and these posters for yourself, have a cup of coffee, and get a tour of the station. We are open 9 to 5. We are the one media outlet in this town.
It doesn't have to be a special day to take a tour of KBOO. Come on down anytime and join. 877-500-5266. Our doors are open during business hours every day. We talk to people. 877-500-5266 or kboo.fm. Those are the ways to connect with us for contribution. It's easy, it's peasy, and it's fun. It's a fun place to be, fun to listen to, and it always feels good to actually be a contributing member. Contribute to the $88 an hour it takes to run this place. Contribute just to our electric bill. Contribute to what we need to keep things going on, to educate people.
We run through a lot of equipment. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, 24/7,
365, a lot of equipment.
500 volunteers. We're talking a lot of headphones.
Just wanted to let you know that this is a great time to call because in a minute or two, we're going to have Black Book Talk with law professor David Trout, author of The Price of Paradise, The Cost of Inequality, and A Vision for a More Equitable America. And we do have that book too. But right now, we do want you to call, especially if you're interested in the Big and Awesome Bridges poster and book from our guest today, Sharon Wood Wharton. I just want to make sure I get that name right. She is one of the cornerstones of KBOO building up the great public affairs programming that you enjoy here, listening to authors, local authors, visiting authors, people with something to say. And we would love it if you had something to say and called toll-free 877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO. Or if you don't want to say anything at all, give us a call or go online at kboo.fm. Donate today in the upper right-hand corner.
Good morning, and welcome to the May edition of Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch.
And O.B. Hill.
And joining us soon, we hope, will be Emma Jackson Ford. But our guest this morning is Professor David Dante Trout. We're going to discuss his book, The Price of Paradise, The Cost of Inequality, and A Vision for a More Equitable America. We are going to start by reading a quote from his book, and then we will invite Professor Trout to the air. This quote is a part of a conversation that he was having with someone on a train from Washington, D.C. to New York City. The person says, he says, and our professor says, just when I thought I had challenged this person's thinking an iota, he sighed and said this: "All we can ever do is live in the present. Whatever happened in the past to create these bad places and all the pathologies you find there is really not my responsibility. The fact is, in the present, these are not people you want to live around. They're not like you and me. If we're talking about the poor, the ghetto barrio poor, the gangbanger poor, no way. You don't want that kind of person watching you leave home every day for work. You don't want him and his friends talking to your daughter, and you damn sure don't want your kids in the same class with them. You just don't. It's hard enough to try to figure out how to raise your kids safely today. The last thing you want to do is sacrifice your sense of peace and security for the good of people who are generally so far gone in their ways of thinking and handling problems. They're so angry and so quick to violence, so high and looking to get higher, that I don't care who you are, black, white, or purple, you don't want to be anywhere near that nonsense. Bottom line, nobody's that liberal unless they're stupid. Me, it's about protecting what I have. If that's selfish, I earn the right to be selfish. They can have my sympathy, but not my neighborhood. Again, this is a passage from The Price of Paradise, The Cost of Inequality, and A Vision for a More Equitable America by David Dante Trout. Professor Trout, welcome to Black Book Talk. Could you just say something else for a minute? You were a little bit low.
Oh, am I low? Unfortunately, I couldn't get to a landline.
That's okay. No, now you're fine. You're fine. Welcome. You have some interesting conversations.
That was a tough one.
That was a tough one. Did you ever, get through to him? I'm sure this doesn't sound like a person whose mind you can change, but, make a dent in any way?
You know, I'm not sure. And, of course, that happened before so many of the events of the last year. And so I imagine that as we pass Baltimore and other places, you know, this individual, wherever he is, you know, has had an opportunity to reflect on that conversation and others he's had. And, of course, he's not the only person. I mean, this is a sort of a middle-aged white businessman on the Amtrak along the Northeast Corridor, you know, probably passing from one place of commerce and wealth to another place of residence and privilege. And his reality could not be more different. But his sentiments are not unique to that position in life. I mean, you'll talk to many people who grew up in low-income neighborhoods who share a lot of those feelings, and they're very steadfast about those sentiments. These are quite, I think, authentic and legitimate sentiments. I don't have all the answers, but I do know that so much of that passage reflects the way the book is built. The book is built around six assumptions that many Americans hold. And it is the problem with these assumptions that has ultimately led us to Ferguson and to Baltimore, as well as a lot of places that have yet to explode, but which are sort of dying a slow death in poverty or near poverty around the country every day.
Okay, first I want to say that Emma Jackson Ford, our third co-host producer, is on the line. So, hey, Emma, welcome.
Good morning.
Okay, and then could you tell us a little bit more about what these assumptions are and how they are played out, how they affect us?
Sure. So the book is really, you know, you can have these conversations with your progressive friends where you bemoan, you know, the idiocy of conservatives over and over again, but you're not getting anywhere. And you realize that this is about all of us. This is about our country. This is about a failed social contract. It's about a country in which it has become much more difficult to make it to the middle class, to remain in the middle class. We've taken real structural hits to upward mobility. And yet at the same time, we are suffering from an inability to see each other's fate as connected to our own. And so what I'm trying to generate in this book is a real conversation about structural inequality, where we begin with an interrogation of the assumptions that most of us hold about the American dream, but which I don't believe hold anymore. And so the first assumption is that, you know, to be middle class, one is self-sufficient. And it turns out, of course, historically, that's just not true. The middle class in the United States is really built through a very generous government, primarily in the post-war years. Of course, it began with the New Deal, but in the post-war years, all the many federal acts that created wonderful largesse on behalf of returning veterans and created the suburban middle class and the single-family detached home, which is the primary source of wealth for most families. All of these things were subsidized by federal and state governments, and for good reason. It was good public policy. The unfortunate thing is it was denied to many Americans based on race, which means that those who were excluded from it struggled much more, and they struggled intergenerationally to acquire wealth, and those who were included got the benefit of exclusion, which increased the value of the subsidy. So that's the first one. The second one is the one that raises the specter of this man on the train, and that is that we maintain our middle class status by keeping some physical distance from the poor. And many of us believe that our middle class status is at risk if we live anywhere near poor people. And this is not science, this is just belief. There are plenty of studies, practices, many of our Western nation friends have mixed income communities as a matter of course. And so it's simply not true that living among poor people will ruin your middle class life. But we believe it. And as a result, we have supported legally and in policy a lot of economic and racial segregation, which you see literally exploding in our faces in many of these communities around the country right now. So
okay, we're going to ask you to hold for just a minute. We are in a pledge period, and at least once during this program, we're going to have to stop and remind people of how lucky they are to hear you and us, we hope, and to encourage them to continue to support us and support this kinds of programming.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for our guest today. I love, you know, George Carlin used to say about the American dream, they call it a dream because you've got to be asleep to believe it. But that's something that you can be awake for right now and call 877-500-5266 because that is the number to support KBOO, to support Black Book Talk, pretty much the premier African-American book show on the airwaves today because there's no place else you're going to find this. 877-500-5266 or KBOO.FM. And I believe folks have been calling, eh?
People have been calling. We want to thank Matthew in Vancouver, new member. Thank you, Matthew. We have many, many friends in Southwest Washington who enjoy listening to KBOO and enjoy the unique programming and the public affairs. Michelle is renewing. Michelle is a member in Portland. Thank you so much, Michelle. And we, of course, have friends in the Gorge and in the Valley on our translators here. But we want all of you to either go online at kboo.fm, look for that jar that says, it's a funny little jar icon that says donate today. Just a few fields to click in and maybe a thank you gift to grab. Or you can come into 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Why not? It's a nice day. Come in and get a tour of the station and get a cup of coffee. But my favorite way to call in is toll-free, 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. And you've been enjoying this guest. This guest is an amazing fellow. Yes, he is a law professor, and he has written a book which is available. Is that correct?
I believe so. It's going to be available for a minimum donation of $60. It sounds really good. I am. These are the sort of things we talk about on KBOO all the time. The deal about the American dream, keeping physical distance from the poor, for Pete's sakes. Thank you so much for talking about this today because it's so important. So if you want to read the whole thing in its entirety, $60, $5, $60 minimum contribution, $5 a month. By calling 877-500-5266. It's really easy. It's going to be really informative. It's called The Price. I'm trying to
the
read.
The Price of Paradise.
The Price of Paradise.
It's a $27 retail value for only a $60
pledge. $60 for The Price of Paradise. That is a great idea.
And that's a low price.
And that's your contribution, $5 a month to KBOO for the whole year. It's a great thing. We love sustaining members. We love all members. But this is a great idea. Are we going to go on back? Because I want to hear more.
Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Professor Trout, continue. You were talking about the assumptions, and we may kind of jump in at any point, but it is just very interesting to hear what these are and have time to consider them.
Yeah, well, just to sort of run them off. So I think the next one is that segregation no longer exists, except mm-hmm. where it's just voluntary. Another is that racism no longer diminishes minority chances. Another one is that that poverty results from poor values and weak decisions. And the last one is that racial labels no longer matter.
Exactly.
Which is really sort of, you know, actually that last one gets a little tricky in the discussion in the book because it's a little bit about the flaws of calling ours a post-racial country or assuming colorblindness, even though many people assume colorblindness in a very goodwill way. But the other part of that, and I just mentioned it, is the presumed solidarity that exists between, say, blacks and Latinos, who are often, you know, phrased together, you know, in the same comments about inequality or a lack of opportunity, but who in lived experience, you know, are often at odds. And it's you know, there are important divisions between the communities that have to be acknowledged before we are really able to see our fates as intertwined.
Emma, are you with us here?
I am with you. I am listening and thinking. I was thinking about the school in which I teach. I was thinking about how this is an intentional community that was built from a Hope 6 grant, supposedly houses people from different countries, but also different economic groups. It's only 9 years, so it's too soon to really tell if this is going to work out. But very interesting, the whole thought.
Okay, you know, I want to say to people that this is a scholarly work and that it's very well researched and you know, marvelous notations. But this is also a very accessible work. I just wanted to read the chapter headings because I think that'll give people a sense of who this book is for. Number one, Mutuality, The Thief, The Preacher, and The Late Night Lawyer. Two, All This I Made Myself, Assuming That Middle Class Lives Are Self-Sufficient. Three, Keep Your Distance, Assuming That Middle Class Status Requires Distance from the Poor. Four, The Promise Half Empty, Assuming That Segregation Is a Thing of the Past. Five, We Renamed the Problem and It Disappeared, Assuming That Racism No Longer Limits Minority Chances. Six, Islands Without Paradise, Assuming That Poverty Results from Weak Values and Poor Decisions. Raceless Wonders, Assuming That Racial Labels No Longer Matter. And eight, The Cost of Inequality and a Vision for a More Equitable America. Could you talk a little bit more about, that poverty results from weak values and poor decisions? Because we so demonize the poor when we talk about them at all. They are pretty much invisible in political rhetoric and other rhetoric. And when the poor are spoken of, it's as if they have chosen to be poor if they would just do a little bit better, make better decisions, which is so true. But could you just speak a little bit more about that?
Sure. No, it's one of my favorite topics, although it's a very complicated and difficult subject. I mean, look, on one hand, there are some facts that we just have to come to grips with in this country. First of all, we have very little welfare net. So to claim that the poor are lazy and just receiving welfare is just factually inaccurate. I mean, everything changed in 1996. And so that language about welfare chiefs, et cetera, that belongs to a different century. Secondly, most poor people in this country, that is people who have incomes below poverty, work and work more than one job. And so the issues of income inequality that you hear about so often now have to do with how people with weak educational backgrounds fare in the current labor market. And they don't fare well because of the way we've deregulated a lot of things, the way wages have not kept up with inflation, the way part-time work has trended. So you have very hardworking people who are nevertheless working poor, and they include many people that we know. I mean, the people who served you coffee this morning, the people who clean your hotel room, the people that, you know, may work at the cleaners or deliver your food, these are working poor people for the most part, and many of them we entrust with the care of our children and other things. So these folks are us. So the facts are important to recognize. Beyond that, though, we have concentrated poverty. And concentrated poverty is really the worst kind of poverty. And more research is coming out to show us that if you live in an area where more than a certain percentage of families have incomes below poverty, like 30 to 40% or more, you're in an area of concentrated, isolated poverty where the institutions no longer work. And you are just living in this kind of a segregated, opportunity poor place. It is really those sorts of places, I think, where we assume that the worst values prevail and the worst decisions occur. And some of that is true to a certain extent. And the book talks about, you know, some studies, some sociological studies that might suggest, you know, objectively, people may be doing things that might not be in their best long-term interest and all kinds of stuff. But what I'm going after in that discussion, in the discussion of the concentrated poor, is a little more compassion for what those environments are really like. Because it turns out that when you look at the public health data, people who grow up many, I don't want to say all people, but many people who grew up in areas of concentrated poverty are struggling against some constraints, the likes of which only our returning war veterans understand. And we have great sympathy for what our returning war veterans go through. And we are now beginning to recognize the ravages of PTSD and what it means socially and developmentally and in terms of their future health, as well as just the terror that they experience psychologically. But what we forget is that in many high poverty schools in high poverty neighborhoods, you have kids, you know, who did not choose their circumstances, did not make any of the decisions that got them there, sitting in a third grade class, and 60 to 70% of them show some signs of trauma-related disease, if not full-blown PTSD or major depressive disorder.
Professor Trout, we're going to hold this thought, let our audience think about this, but we're going to break for just a few minutes. Okay, so, all right, we're turning it back over to you,
Thank
folks.
You so much, Patricia. You know, I loved what he said about opportunity poor people and how David Trout's book seems to be looking at social issues with terms of compassion instead of judgment. And that's something we really try to do at News and Public Affairs here at KABU, because there's enough nasty judgment out there on the media. That is not the sort of thing we do. And keep that sort of, if that means something to you, if compassion means something to you, give us a call at 877-500-5266 with your pledge of support right now. And you can get this book, the Price of Paradise, God, I love it, for a $60 minimum pledge of support today by law professor David Trout. Call on in at 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm and you can support Black Book Talk and get this incredible book.
You know, I'm old enough to remember when commercial radio stations and commercial TV stations had amazing guests, you know, much like Law Professor David Trout, our author today. They had them on for long-form interviews. I mean, that was back decades ago. Yeah, and the year I spent in Toronto, they still have amazing authors on the broadcast television and radio stations. But now here in Portland, it really is just KABU that has amazing folks, people like David Trout, and you know, a whole half hour to talk about this book, Price of Paradise, The Costs of Inequality and a Vision for a More Equitable America. This is the one place where we take authors seriously, where we take artists seriously, where we take musicians seriously. And we want to make sure that you have a chance to support that.
You know, I just say, as a member of the Black Book Talk team, for goodness gracious, Obi, how long have we been on the air? 15, more than 15 years. I'm just really proud that we can bring this kind of information to the public here. I mean, everybody knows that Portland has a relatively small African-American community. And for folks who've lived in other, quite frankly, more racially and culturally rich areas, maybe what we're doing is taken for granted, but in Portland, it is so important that people hear the other voices, the other perspectives. It is so important that people understand the kind of research, the kind of thinking that the Black intelligentsia, and not just the folks that we see all the time on TV and here on the radio, that there are discussions being had, that there are ideas being shared, and you know, it's important that we bring these things to the community. So we are just really proud that, at least I know I am really proud, that we can bring this kind of discussion, and this is just a start. We're obviously going to have to bring Professor Trout back so that we can talk a bit more, because these are ideas that we need to think about and we need to discuss and we need to share and see what we can implement to make a difference.
Let me chime in here. Professor, the issue of baby boomers and others growing old, those people who are placed in rest homes in areas that we're talking about, do you discuss that in your book?
Well, not so much. You know, part of the sort of demographic pull of the book is, yes, on the one hand, you know, where an aging population that is getting older and older than perhaps any generation in history, just because life expectancy is extended for many people more than in the past, on one hand. And then on the other hand, the emerging majority of minority people, and what that means for the whole notion of opportunity and the social contract in this country. So one of the kind of urgent demographic facts that is a premise of the book is that while many of the assumptions that I just outlined may have held for the baby boomer generation, they will not hold for this generation, or even for the one preceding it, because already the top 100 metropolitan areas of the country are made up of a majority of minority people, and in that means in all of their school districts, in the public school districts, a majority of the kids are of color. And then, of course, we know many of them, the majority of kids are Black and Latino, who don't tend to do as well as their Asian counterparts educationally, and don't, therefore, and for other reasons, enjoy the same opportunities. But they will make up the voting bloc, and they will make up the largest voting bloc, and they will make up the labor market, and they will make up so much of the leadership class, and so much of whom we expect to sort of drive this country's success forward in the future. And if they are not given the building blocks of opportunity that the generation, that the baby boomer generation experienced, then we will all be affected by it. So the debunking of these assumptions that really relate to a different time is absolutely critical as we gear up for what the very near future will hold.
You know, I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. I grew up in the 21217 zone, which is the area where a lot of the uprisings are taking place. And you know, I look at television, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, that's over there. Everybody talks about the CVS, but it's also over there near the library. And as a librarian, that's important to me. But I have seen the difference in my community over the years. So the things that we're addressing are really very personal to me. I know that you are a... you're a professor of law and justice, and the John J. Francis. You are the John J. Francis Scholar at Rutgers University, Newark Law School. You are also the director of the Center on Law and Metropolitan Equity at Rutgers Law School. But tell us a little bit about your background and how you became, you know, why this is important, and of all the areas you could have addressed, why you chose to do this.
Well, that's an interesting question, and one I'm almost never asked. It's funny. So I grew up in Harlem, and so I grew up at a time where, you know, we were sort of on the edge of a lot of things, you know, in the 60s and the 70s. And there was great promise and great fear and a fair amount of experimentation. And we let a lot of it go. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of backlash. I think people do not fully appreciate what the 80s represented in terms of the backlash on the promise of all sorts of good public policy that we fought very hard to put in place as a nation. And we just didn't give it time. I mean, we get mass incarceration in the 1980s, and I remember when crack came into my neighborhood in 1984. It was one of the first neighborhoods to experience crack, you know, and it was just both were devastating. Crack was devastating, mass incarceration was devastating, and quietly, the whole notion of opportunity that we had begun to have faith in the 1970s begins to slip away. And not surprisingly, 20, 30 years later, you know, as various institutional policies take root in the 1980s, you know, we're seeing all this structural inequality come to fruition now. So I saw a lot of stuff. I felt like I was part of a generation that was experiencing great promise and a degree of betrayal. You know, we had fought a lot of fights, and people are tired of fighting now, but we're living with the mess. And I feel obligated to try to bring some insight to a conversation that has to get richer on behalf of all of us. Plus, I'm a dad, and I got kids who got to live in this world. So.
All right. we're coming to the close of the program. This is obviously a conversation that is just beginning, and we certainly hope that you'll come back and join us. Let's see. Emma, did you have, like, in the, like, 30 seconds left, is there anything you wanted to ask or add?
I was just going to ask if he was going on the circuit. So will he be coming to Portland?
Yes.
You know, I don't know that I'm on the circuit. You know, I would love to. I mean, these are conversations that really need to happen all the time now. I mean, one thing I would invite you all to do is to look at this recent Harvard study, the Moving to Opportunity study, by the Center, I think it's the Center on Equality. It's another good conversation starter, but it says a lot about the importance of communities considering that second assumption. When low-income people move into middle-income neighborhoods, really good things happen. That's the bottom line there, and that's what we need much more. We need a reinvigoration of a belief in a community that includes all of us, and not just policies that say, well, if we just put more resources over there, things will work out, but I give nothing else up.
We need you to come back, come out here, and join us in this conversation. But again, thank you so much for joining us today. Folks, this is Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch, the Library Lady.
O.B. Hill with Mirror Image Books.
Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And we are saying thank you for joining us today. Good reading to you. And please, you know, if you're not aware of it, you know, please take the time to read the book, The Price of Paradise, The Cost of Inequality, and The Vision for a More Equitable America. Thank you, Professor David Dante Trout.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
You're listening to the KBOO News at Noon. President Obama is visiting Portland today. He will land this evening at around 5 p.m. to attend a Democratic National Committee fundraiser. He will also spend tomorrow morning at the Nike headquarters in Beaverton to promote the free trade agreement known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. Opponents of the TPP have planned protests outside the Nike headquarters and outside the DNC fundraiser at the Sentinel Hotel downtown. This means that evening traffic will look a little different tonight. The president's visit means that TriMet expects delays of at least 30 minutes in the city center area. Streetcars are running modified services today and tomorrow, with no streetcar service on Southwest and Northwest 10th and 11th Avenues